everyone, this is your co-host Olivia Shizuhiga.
And I'm your other co-host, Therese Santiago. Before we begin, I'd like to provide a brief trigger warning. This episode will cover topics including sexual violence, racism, xenophobia, and death. Listener discretion is advised. On March 17th, we woke up to the news that a gunman had shot and killed 8 people in Atlanta, 6 of whom were Asian women. In the 2 months since then, we have been left reeling from the impact of their deaths, with this incident being only one of thousands of hate crimes against Asian people that has occurred since the start of the pandemic.
Despite the media's initial reluctance to name the shooter's motive, we know almost certainly why events like this one have persisted. The combination of racism and sexism specifically directed toward Asian women. We're still left with many questions, namely, why was the Atlanta shooting, along with many other anti-Asian hate crimes, specifically directed toward Asian women? What historical circumstances led to the rise in anti-Asian hate crimes we've seen today? And how is it that violence against Asian women has been normalized and condoned for so long? These are the questions we're going to begin to answer in this podcast.
Thank you for tuning in to the first episode of No History, No Self, a 3-part podcast series dedicated to understanding the historic and current sexualization of Asian women, both in light of the violent hate crimes that have escalated against this demographic throughout this year and in honor of AAPI Heritage Month. The name of our podcast comes from a loose interpretation of a quote by Jose Rizal, a Philippine revolutionary, who argues that we can't understand ourselves without first understanding history, and we feel this is especially true when it comes to understanding the root of the violence that Asian women face today.
Through our podcast, we hope to not only provide a historical overview of violence against Asian women, we also want to provide personal stories and experiences surrounding this complex and layered issue. Today, we have a wonderful guest, Grace Poon Ghaffari, joining us. Grace Poon Ghaffari uses she/her pronouns, and she is a sexual violence prevention specialist, anti-racist educator, trauma-informed healer, and a PhD student. She is also the founder of Asian Women College Survivors, which is a collective community that centers Asian women survivors of sexual, relationship, and gender-based violence within the context of higher ed. As an Asian American woman, Grace understands how racism, sexism, and other forms of oppression uniquely intersect to shape abuse and systemic violence. Hence, Grace is passionate about transforming systems and environments that prioritize the needs of all marginalized populations and regularly presents workshops on issues of diversity, inclusion, and equity.
Thank you again for being here with us, Grace. So before we begin our conversation, let's start with some recent context. Since March 2020, Stop AAPI Hate has reported 6,600 hate crimes against Asian American and Pacific Islander women and girls. Our podcast will be specifically focused on violence against Asian women.
In today's episode, we will talk about the precarious context into which Asian women arrived in this country, where they were immediately met with some of the damaging stereotypes and violence that we will discuss later in this episode. There's a large body of legislative and cultural history relating to this topic, but today we'll specifically be focusing on the implication of the Page Act of 1875, the Expatriation Act of 1907, and the War Brides Act of 1945 in relation to the Atlanta shooting. Before we dive in, we want to first acknowledge our positionality as your hosts and introduce ourselves. So Therese, do you want to start?
Sure. So as I said earlier, I'm Therese. I use she/her pronouns, and I'm a queer second-generation Filipino immigrant. My parents came to the U.S. in the 90s, and I've been raised almost entirely in the Fresno Central Valley of California. At Stanford, I study English and comparative studies in race and ethnicity, with a particular focus on narratives by and about people of color in America. Outside of school, I'm a writer and portrait photographer, and I love using both of these mediums to tell stories about the people I love. I am a huge fan of sitcoms, especially Parks and Rec and Superstore, and I also love cooking, especially creamy pastas and all kinds of Asian food. So to our listeners, if we're ever in the same area, I would love to cook for you sometime.
So, hi everyone. My full name is Olivia Shizuhiga, but you can call me Liv, and I use she, they pronouns. I'm a 1.5 generation Okinawan Japanese immigrant. My family immigrated to the West Coast when I was very young, and since then, I've grown up in the Bay Area with the rest of my extended family still living across the ocean. My name Shizu means kokoro wo yasuraka ni suru, which means to put your heart to ease and to tend to things with care and detail. And like Therese, in a few months, I'll be graduating college, or a few days actually, but we'll both be pursuing master's in sociology. I am a dancer, I love to cook and knit and take film photos, and I'm also an avid movie watcher. As I get older, I'm learning the importance of always centering my identity and positionality in every decision I make and opportunity I encounter, so I'm so grateful to be able to take on this project with Therese. My hope is that this can be our small contribution into creating a more just and inclusive world that ourselves and those that will follow us will be able to live. And then Grace, do you want to share a little bit about yourself too?
Yeah, definitely. So my name is Grace Pungafari. I use she, her pronouns. I am Chinese American. I identify as cisgender. And I also am a child of immigrants and the only daughter. I grew up in the Bay Area. And so I was not born here, but I immigrated when I was really young. So definitely the Bay Area is definitely where I would call my hometown. I would say that I grew up in a community that was predominantly filled with a lot of Asians. And I would also say that I went to UC Irvine, which had a high population of the Asian community. So yeah, that's a little bit about my background.
Thank you again, Grace. We are very excited to chat with you today. We want to first acknowledge the limitations of our podcast, especially given our identities as East and Southeast Asian women. The experiences we will speak about here and the information we will provide is only a sliver of the research on this topic that exists. We know that the term Asian American is a broad label that doesn't always account for the nuances and privileges that exist within this broader identity, and we want to be mindful of that going forward. Having said that, our focus will primarily cover the experiences of East and Southeast Asian women at Stanford, and in future episodes, we hope to hear from a more expansive range of guest speakers, especially highlighting the voices of South, Central Asian women, and Pacific Islander women.
Yeah, amazing. Let's dive in. So when most people think of anti-Asian legislation, the first thing they can recall is the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. It's usually cited as the first immigration and explicitly anti-Asian law in America, but there's actually something that precedes this bill. And I know that I was personally never taught about it until college, but Therese, do you know what I'm talking about?
The PAGE Act, right?
Yeah, so there's no shortage of racist pieces of immigration legislation, but for the purpose of this episode, we'll focus on dissecting the PAGE Act. And for those of you who might be unfamiliar with this legislation, the PAGE Act was passed in 1875, 7 years before the Chinese Exclusion Act. It was a piece of legislation that specifically targeted and prohibited the immigration of, quote, subjects of China, Japan, or any Oriental country coming for, quote, lewd and immoral purposes. The bill specifically singled out Asian women by saying that those who aided the immigration of Asian women found to be prostitutes could be imprisoned for up to 5 years, and it officially set a precedent of criminalizing undocumented immigration. The implication here was that Asian women would bring virulent strains of venereal diseases while simultaneously enticing young white boys to a life of sin.
Yeah, so I just said a lot.
Yeah, there's a whole lot to unpack there, a lot of detail. So Therese, I'll let you decide what you want to tackle first.
Yes, so much to unpack there, but let's just go back a few more steps to provide a little more context. So this is all happening in the mid-19th century when large numbers of primarily Chinese immigrant men were coming to America at the height of the gold rush. Around this time, the American Medical Association thought that Chinese immigrants, quote, carry distinct germs to which they were immune, but from which whites would die if exposed, end quote. So this is obviously a pretty messed up idea that led to a lot of animosity towards and fear against Chinese women who were thought to pass these germs onto white men when working as prostitutes, which would also result in the corruption of the so-called white values and way of life. The Page Act was meant to prevent supposed moral corruption brought about by Chinese women in particular, which thus created some of the stereotypes that we frequently see today of Asian women being hypersexualized and vilified in the media.
Yeah. And Grace, as someone who is an expert in how we educate about people's sexuality, I'm sure there are a lot of red flags here. And do you want to just speak about your initial thoughts on this legislation?
Yeah, definitely. So the Page Act was particularly targeting against East Asian women, and so and it operated and mostly to really ban Chinese women from immigrating by portraying them as prostitutes. And so really this contributed and was really fed by the fetishized narrative of really portraying Asian women as exotic and also sexual objects and also immoral. And we're really still living through the legacies of the Page Act. We're really seen as sexual temptations, and yet we're deracialized or, not seen as experiencing racism because of stereotypes like the model minority myth. And so it's important to really see these different acts like the Page Act as interwoven with different kind of systems of oppression. And really specifically within the Page Act, racist misogyny is really at play that continues to contribute to the sexual objectification, harassment, and violence that is frequently experienced by Asian American women.
And I think when we reference the Page Act, it's usually in relation between kind of Asian women and white America. But I was wondering if you think it had effects between interracial relationships, like within Asian dynamics and genders, yeah.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think that a lot of times this also feeds into the I think cultural expectations also that's fueling how Asian women are seen as also supposed to be both pious, carrying the respectability, and so I think that it's like a double bind where Asian men are expecting Asian women to be pure or virginal or sexually immoral. And yet there's legislation that continues to perpetuate the idea or notion that Asian women are sexually open, that they can be objectified, that they're for the pleasure of white men. And it makes it so that Asian men can see Asian women to blame if they do engage in the sex industry, or if they are found to have experienced sexual violence. And so those are, I think, the really challenging myriad of different obstacles that Asian women constantly experience, both with cultural norms that are constantly boxing us in, and then also with a lot of this type of legislation that is obviously fed from racist and sexist notions, to really be capturing what the public imagination is of Asian women. And so essentially, Asian women are then kind of no longer able to be who they actually want to be and really name for themselves any self-determined kind of trajectory for their future.
Yeah, thank you so much for that answer, Grace. I really appreciate the concept of self-determination that you brought up because I think it's really important for us to be grounded in the knowledge that we can determine our futures, especially when being sexualized in the media. The concept of hypersexualization of Asian women is actually really interesting to me because we've talked about this before, Therese, but growing up, I really thought that Asians couldn't be pretty. I just remember never seeing them in magazines or TV shows, and we were always depicted as these nerdy kids who had tiger parents and no social lives, or you had such absurd caricatures like Mr. Yuniyoshi in Breakfast at Tiffany's. So it really wasn't until college that this concept of hypersexualized Asian women rose in my consciousness.
Yeah, no, I agree. I felt really similarly growing up, and I constantly felt like I was working against the broader model minority stereotype without Also realizing that I was existing against the media's hypersexualization of Asian women. And I also had no idea that any of this history that we've discussed existed until college. And so Grace, we were wondering if you shared this experience of being educated on these concepts later in life, and if you also had comments on the relatively late education of the population at large on racist, misogynistic policies like this.
Yeah, I think that our education system definitely is biased towards white dominance and supremacy, and normalizing that as the narrative that we'll always really be buying into. And so I also agree, from a young age, I never really learned too much about Asian American history. And if I did, I learned it from the lens of white dominance, and really touching upon really small little things like how, you know, Chinese men were railroad workers, or the Chinese Exclusion Act, but really not necessarily understanding the critical nuances of why that was significant, and really kind of painting it as just kind of facts and then kind of moving it forward, right? And so, which is obviously intentional, and so that we don't necessarily raise our critical consciousness to be able to understand our own history, to then be able to critically and interrogate our situations that we're in, right? And so I definitely also agree. Like I constantly think about this a lot in terms of how I'm going to be educating my children. I should have mentioned this in the beginning. I'm also going to be a mom. So I'm currently pregnant with a little baby daughter. And I actually had really kind of found out that I'm having a daughter at the same time the Atlanta shootings were happening. And so it was a very embodied experience for me. Understanding that, you know, this is not just going to be my experience, but also the experience of my baby girl growing up in a world that is really constantly objectifying Asian women, right? And so how am I going to educate my daughter to understand our history, and to also understand that we can choose our own destiny while still knowing the facts of our reality too? So I think a lot now about our education systems and what ways that I can combat so many different false messages that we get every single day, whether through our school systems or through the media, or just the ways that people talk to one another.
Yeah, first of all, congratulations. That's so exciting.
Thank you.
Yes, congratulations, Grace. It's very exciting to hear that you're going to have a baby girl, and we know you're going to make such an excellent mother. And I really appreciate your intentionality in answering this question and the approach you're planning to take in raising your daughter in the landscape we're living in, through educating her on all of these things. When looking to future generations, as our podcast name suggests, it's so important to look back at the past and understand the forces and ideas that created the current moment.
Yeah, and that's why it's so important to understand this history through the concept of Orientalism, which situates white America's positioning to Asian immigrants. This was a theory that was really canonized by Edward Said. And in short, Orientalism is a lens of understanding global civilization and a product of colonialism defined by an unequal exchange between the dominant West and the exploited East. In this constructive relationship, the Orient only exists in relation to the West, and unequal power dynamics are maintained and reproduced through the non-consensual stripping of material, socioeconomic, political, and narrative power.
Mm-hmm. And it's so clear to see how legislation like the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which prohibited all immigration of Chinese laborers, and the Page Act, which we've just discussed, played right into tropes of Orientalism. These legislation are all about prompting recurring images of the other and constructing dominant ideas of who belongs and who doesn't. And back then, Asian men and women could never be American and thus couldn't belong. Grace, could you speak to how you think Oriental tropes play into how Asian women have been and continue to be sexualized?
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, stereotypes, especially around the Orient or Oriental tropes, they really kind of centralize around three really core ideas. And so one is the perpetual foreigner idea, where Asian Americans and Asian communities are never seen as truly American, quote unquote. And then, the second one is around the threat to like proper functioning of our society. That's why the Page Act was fueled with really kind of ideas and notions about Chinese women being prostitutes, and therefore they're going to be the peril for all morality to really be coming at doom. And then the third one is around how sexuality and gender identities are deviant, right? And so that also fuels into racist, misogynistic kind of ideas around who is, supposed to be pure and who is supposed to be wanted by our beauty standards. There's, obviously very little representation within the media. And when we kind of think about beauty standards, we often do not think about Asian women. But if we think about sex industry standards, then we think about Asian women, but only in very subservient or even in very violent specific images. And so really thinking about sexuality and gender identities as really playing into what is seen as deviant and not norm, seen as like kind of quote unquote like the kind of Jezebels of our society. And so that really feeds into narratives around like fetishization, submissiveness, exotic lotus flowers, Asian prostitutes, yellow peril, dragon ladies, always seen as like we're innately immoral and sexual. And this has really been playing out a lot within how Asian women navigate these hostile stereotypes when it comes to also sexual exploitation, objectification, and really. That really couches within how a lot of violence is enacted against Asian women too. I think for me, personally, I also share this as well, is that I'm a survivor of dating violence, and a lot of my experiences of abuse were a lot having to do with both of these kind of a lot of these tropes that were played out constantly in my relationship and the expectations that were placed on me, and also how like his friends had seen me as well and were kind of like expecting of me as well. And so I think that always is contextualizing these oriental kind of tropes are always contextualizing how people interact and view Asian women and really plays out with violence and harm that's enacted against Asian women.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that experience, Grace. I know that in processing difficult situations, it can be really useful to have context to make sense of how such events came to be. And experiences like the one that you mentioned just go to show how ideas like Orientalism, which might initially seem outdated or no longer relevant, really have an impact on the present moment.
Yeah, definitely. And I also want to add, Orientalism is a myth. It's a myth that perpetuates ideas of a monolithic race, and it honestly just serves to uphold a racial hierarchy that elevates white people. If you think about the Page Act, its basic premise was about protecting the moral superiority and sanctity of young white boys. I think that in 2021, as individuals, we're doing a better job of disaggregating what it means to have pan-ethnic labels, but government policies haven't necessarily caught up.
Right, and it's crazy that when we think about the Page Act, it applied to a fairly limited group at the time, but it had so many implications for the broader Asian diaspora. So the Page Act and Chinese Exclusion Act specifically impacted Chinese women based on immigration at that time. But Filipino immigrants to the US, for example, were working against policies enacted as a result of Spanish and American colonization, which resulted in labor export policies that have still influenced both migration and harmful stereotypes about this ethnic group today.
Yeah, and then to put this narrative side by side with the fact that Asian men are so emasculated in our society, I remember reading some articles that said that Asian men are globally consistently ranked as the least desirable in terms of attractiveness. And there's no doubt that this desexualization is a product of Americans trying to minimize the threat that Chinese men posed. Grace, how do you view the juxtaposition between the hypersexualization of Asian men and women and the complete desexualization of Asian men?
Yeah, so As I've been, diving into this topic, I'm also going to be doing my dissertation. I'm a PhD student, so I'm doing my dissertation on Asian American college women survivors of sexual violence. And this idea that I've been recently kind of reading more about is really around Sunny Wan's work in this article in 2008, where Sunny Wan talks about Western sexual imperialism. Which is based on notions of white dominance and supremacy. And it always operates in a way to essentially make it so that Asian women are viewed as consumed objects for the sexual pleasure of white men, while also at the same time, when we're kind of thinking about, who is going to be positioned with higher power? It's white men, right? And what is going to be providing more power to white men? It's going to be the desexualization of Asian men as well, because they are setting the standards also of what is seen as masculine, right? And so this kind of feeds into the ideas. This is blending into some other kind of scholarship too about around like white toxic masculinity and how white toxic masculinity is really forming the norm standards of what is construed as masculinity or what we kind of conceptually think about as hegemonic masculinity. And so if we make it so that Asian men are seen as less masculine, not as a threat to white hegemonic dominance, then we're able to constantly also hypersexualize Asian women for the pleasure of white men, right? Because white men are seen as the only options for Asian women to then be able to desire, right? And so it's like almost like a systemic gaslighting concept of who are my options, and who should I desire? And therefore, it feeds into the consumption of Asian women's bodies within this sexual economic matrix of kind of supply and demand also.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I really appreciate what you said at the end about the matrix of supply and demand. So really going to show the direct relationship between capitalism and racist misogyny. The emasculation of Asian men and the hypersexualization of Asian women was, in essence, a racial project that was saying, look, Asian men might steal our jobs, but they can't steal our women. No one will find Asian men attractive, but we can have their Asian women. And on top of that, since Asian women were barred from coming into the country at the time, and anti-miscegenation laws in the US were passed around this time as well, Chinese men didn't have families or children, and they also usually couldn't find jobs due to the racism they faced, which contributed to their emasculation. So there's definitely a correlation here between the Page Act, the emasculation of Asian men, and the hypersexualization of Asian women.
Yeah, exactly. There's this really great quote by Suchin Cheng that I want to read. She talks about the way Asian women were constructed, sexualized, and criminalized as, quote, potential instruments for the debasement of white manhood, health, morality, and family life. Thus, their continued presence was deemed a threat to white civilization, end quote. We've come to call out racism in college admissions, workplaces, and the criminal justice system, but for some reason, when it comes to racial exclusion in dating, we skirt around the issue and call it a personal preference. Grace, do you think that there is a problematic rhetoric surrounding how we talk about race, specifically pertaining to Asians in the dating world? In a 2015 study, they found that Asian men are twice as likely as Asian women to be unpartnered, with that being 35% versus 18%.
I think that it always is an issue when we kind of couch racial preferences as just preferences, regardless of the specific demographic of race. I think specifically for Asians, specifically for Asian women, there's always the stereotypes around, having yellow fever. Or some certain expectations around what this specific racial profile is able to provide for me. It reminds me of the times that I've been approached multiple times by white men because they feel that they know something about my sexual trajectory, right? And so whether it be I'm going to be a freak in the sheets, or you know, but yet respectable in the streets. I've been also told that they thought that I would be good at, you know, dancing because they have seen, you know, other Asian women dancing. And so there's a lot of these different stereotypes that are tied up within these quote unquote racial preferences, right? That is highly problematic because obviously they have these racial preferences because they have these specific racialized fantasies around how they're going to consume Asian women bodies, right? And so it that just contributes to the ways that Asian women are constantly dehumanized and just commodified and exploited. And really we're seen as not people anymore. We're seen as objects to be consumed. I mean, there's obviously a correlation here between why there's such a high prevalence of Asian women represented in violent porn categories, and also a high amount of them that have also been trafficked into sex work, particularly in America. And so I think that it's important to be thinking about how problematic it is to have racial preferences, because the undertones is really around racialized fantasies, which are often very violent, commodification, objectification, dehumanization.
Definitely. And the concept of entitlement to Asian women's bodies that Grace just brought up is one that we really try to highlight in our next few episodes, to show how pervasive and damaging this issue is. And you're totally right, we often evade difficult topics like these when it comes to conversations about racism and anti-Asian racism in particular. And a big reason for this is that people are largely unfamiliar with the legislative and cultural history of Asian women in this country.
Yeah, I agree so much with that. And we've covered a lot already. I know there was a lot of historic details there, so I think this is a great stopping point. And after the break, we'll talk about how World War II and US imperialism affected gender and racial dynamics between Asian women and white men, and finish with analyzing how these histories inform the present moment and tragic incidents of violence like the Atlanta shooting.
Before the intermission, we covered the Page Act and its implications, such as the hypersexualization of Asian women. It also planted the seed of Asian people as a whole being seen as vessels for disease, which we still continue to see today through the current pandemic. And in large part, this confluence of damaging policy and these false beliefs strip many Asian women of their agency. Several policies in later decades reinforce this, including the Expatriation Act of 1907, in which U.S.-born women could lose their citizenship if they married a non-citizen immigrant. So this very heavily affected Asian American women who could lose their citizenship if their husbands were not citizens themselves. Notably, Asian immigrant men were ineligible for citizenship. So for example, if a US-born Chinese woman wanted to marry a Chinese immigrant man, she would lose her citizenship by marrying him. So again, this really contributed to both the emasculation of Asian men and also further the othering and loss of agency that Asian women faced as a result of US policy.
Mm-hmm. And with the hypersexualization of women specifically, we really saw this idea perpetuated during the long list of wars that the US military waged against Asia, when American GIs would participate in the sex industry in Asia. In a separate podcast on this issue, Professor Nancy Wang Yuen from Biola University explained that there were, quote, camp towns that pop up around US military bases, and those camp towns have sex workers. And so the GIs, I think, associate, you know, being in Asia with sex workers, even though Asians are not any more likely to be sex workers than any other race or culture. By 1965, reports showed that 85% of GIs surveyed reported having been with or been out with a prostitute. This created a perception of Asian women's sexual availability and fueled white male entitlement to Asian bodies. These ideas have also had a huge influence on the little Asian representation that existed in pop culture and media from that point forward, with dangerous and life-threatening consequences for Asian women.
And this wasn't just about social attitudes. All of these ideas were supported through legislation. The War Brides Act of 1945 was an amendment to the Chinese Exclusion Act and the Naturalization Act of 1924. And this restricted immigration of Asians and excluded all non-white foreigners from citizenship. So this new law, the War Brides Act, essentially allowed American GIs to bring back Asian wives to the U.S. and have them legally remain in the country. We see here that the sexualization of Asian women, which was once criminalized in the Page Law, was now being reworked to benefit the fetishization of Asian women. And according to immigrationhistory.org, for the next two decades, a significant portion of Asian immigrants were war brides to U.S. military personnel stationed in countries such as Japan, South Korea, Vietnam, and the Philippines. So Grace, we're planning to discuss this in later episodes as well, but I was wondering if you could speak to how legislation like the War Brides Act blends into the phenomena of yellow fever, where there seems to be an overwhelming pattern of white men ending up with Asian women. And I think it's really interesting too, as Liv brought up to me the other day, that the term yellow fever signals ideas of disease and illness, which we've seen racially codified for legislation directed at Asians.
Yeah, wow. There's so much to unpack within that one question. I have so many different thoughts. But I think that, you know, one thing that I will say is that policies and laws have long institutionalized already preconceived racist and sexist stereotypes and ideas regarding the Asian and Asian American community, especially against Asian women. And so there's no surprise there that the War Brides Act was enacted and the outcomes of the War Brides Act as well. I also think that, you know, not just with the War Brides Act, but a lot of these different kind of state sanctioned type of legislation often leads to violence and harm. And in order for us to really understand these everyday acts of violence, where we're seeing things like yellow fever, you know, seeing a lot of the different kind of high rates of sexual harassment against Asian women, obviously, with a pandemic, most of the victims of harassment and violence have been Asian women. In order for us to really understand these type of everyday acts of violence, we have to understand these type of legislations that have continued to really perpetuate and normalize how we view Asian women, right? And so in order for us to understand these daily acts of harm, we need to also understand things like the War Brides Act. And so those are kind of some of the things that I was thinking about too. But I think that, you know, when we're thinking about also where legislation like the War Brides Act had come from, it also comes from the fact that when America enacted or engaged in a lot of these different wars in East Asia, specifically Philippine-American War, World War II, the Vietnam War, their presence and really, you know, American presence is really tied to this fantasy or this dominance, or really thinking about how they own and wanting to objectify the Orient, right? And so, you know, the War Brides Act then kind of feeds into how they can continue to objectify and own the Orient, right? Thinking about how through marriage, they're able to have this person, you know, have a piece of the Orient, right? And so those are kind of the things that I sometimes think about when I kind of think about legislation like the War Brides Act, and, you know, how that kind of feeds into the larger narrative around, you know, who is fetishized, who's ownable, who's objectable, and who is seen as like people that they're able to essentially pay off, you know, whether it be financially or whether it be through citizenship status, in order for me to have a claim on their body.
Yes, and all this connects back to the Atlanta shooting. So, despite the media's initial reluctance to label these shootings as racist and sexist in motive, we can confidently say that they have ties to this historical racism. The shooter claimed that his actions weren't racist, that he was simply eliminating temptation due to his sex addiction, and this is really messed up, quote, helping others eliminate temptation as well by murdering these women. The root of these awful ideas he possessed really stems from the ideas we've been discussing in this episode, that Asian women are sexual objects who either owe their bodies to the pleasure of men or are here to seduce and lead moral men astray, and that this threat is so large that Asian women must be eliminated, as the shooter thought.
This is still early, but he does claim that it was not racially motivated.
Officials said race did not appear to be behind the attacks.
He apparently has an issue, what he considers a sex addiction, and sees these locations as something that allows him to go to these places, and it's a temptation for him that he wanted to eliminate.
But the working theory is a sexual addiction issue rather than a racial profile.
During our interviews, we asked that specific question, and that did not appear to be the motive.
But activist and author Helen Zia said authorities are missing important context.
Hypersexualization of Asian American women is part of the racism toward Asian Americans. And to say that sexual addiction is an excuse or a reason to go on a mass killing rampage is ridiculous. He's going to take the word of a mass shooter who happens to be white against the lived experience of the Asian American community.
Zia also said Captain Jay Baker's description of the suspect's frame of mind was outrageous.
He was pretty much fed up and kind of at the end of his rope, and yesterday was a really bad day for him, and this is what he did.
I couldn't believe that a police captain was recounting the bad day that the killer had without a shred of empathy for the really bad day that the 8 victims and their families had, the incredible grief that the whole community is going through. And this is the kind of thing that makes people question law enforcement and whether they are really there for the people that they're supposed to be protecting.
When the story first broke out, the New York Times and other major news outlets headlined this as a mass shooting with 8 victims, and were really reluctant to address the incident as a specifically anti-Asian and anti-woman hate crime. But I think it's really important that we acknowledge that the perpetrator was a white man targeting working class Asian women. It's an issue of race, gender, and class. These acts of violence are what happens when we leave white supremacist frameworks unchecked and unchallenged.
Exactly. And this has just been my experience, but I don't think that in America we've ever really highlighted the particular vulnerability of Asian women on a national scale. So this reckoning with sexual and racial violence is one that had to happen, but this reckoning did not require a year of violence directed at Asian women of all age ranges for this to start. Grace, I know we were really frustrated with how this was handled by the media, the Atlanta shooting, and we were also wondering what your biggest frustrations about how the shooting was reported. And how do you think that this reporting affected how Asian girls and women might understand their identity in relationship to a white and male-dominated society?
I think that when I was hearing about how the media was portraying the Atlanta shooting, at first it was really frustrating to not necessarily call it racially motivating, and to really focus on it being quote unquote a sex addiction. I think that it makes it so that it feels like the way that the shooter was centered in the narrative really erased the narratives of racist misogyny that was really at play, and allowed the shooter to then control the narrative as, because I'm not saying that it's racially motivated, therefore it's not, or saying that they were my temptations and therefore had to be eliminated, makes it so that it contributes to the narrative that, Asian women are sexual temptations and therefore they should be eliminated. It calls back to the Page Act of those specific same ideas around how Asian women should not be allowed into this country and because they're sexual temptations and need to be eliminated, right? And so when we treat Asian women as if Asian women are the problem, then it contributes to self-blame. It contributes to internalized notions of self-hate. And it makes it so that when Asian women do experience violence, we are not able to really critically name what is actually at play. And we blame ourselves for experiencing the harm and violence that is really part of this larger narrative of racist, misogynistic claims on our bodies. And seeing us as not really truly human.
Definitely. And as we've been talking about throughout the episode, this violence that we saw in Atlanta is something that's not new. And so we're always grappling with the question of how is it that violence like this has been normalized and condoned for so long, but also how do we begin to end this cycle and what paths forward do you see from here? And this will be our last question.
This is definitely part of a long history and part of a broad system. And it's not going to be changed by one legislation or one specific act, unfortunately, but I have seen, some encouragement here and there with different recent things that have happened across our nation. So that gives me some hope. I do think that the way that we continue to view Asian women contributes to the normalization of violence against Asian women in our bodies. And so if we continue to exercise those oriental kind of tropes, if we continue to feed into those different rhetoric narratives in our media, we are not going to be able to move forward in huge ways, right? A lot of these different things will just be band-aid solutions if we don't really correct the ways that we view Asian women as not truly human beings and we continue to objectify our bodies. And so I think that, one way that we can begin is by educating our children, educating each other, being able to share Asian narratives, to be able to center our true lives here and not allow others to tell our stories. I think that that's why it's been so cool, especially, you all are doing this podcast and different ways that we're diversifying how we're getting our stories out there so that we can be able to, connect with other folks who identify as Asian women, and also to humanize our stories, to be able to allow us to speak our truth and not allow others to speak for us.
I agree. And I think it's so important to have our voices heard and not allow others to define our future. So thank you again, Grace, so much for sharing that. And as we look to the future, we were wondering if you had a message of hope you'd like to share, especially for our Femme AAPI listeners as we grapple with the current reality.
Something that I have been thinking about, especially since the Atlanta shootings. And I remember that day, it was super emotional for me. And I wrote a letter to my future daughter. And what I wrote there was that, although I won't be able to protect you for against all the oppressive messages that others will tell to you, I pray that you always remember your true worth and always remember that you are not needing to be defined by others because you have the power to define who you are, and your worth is always inherent regardless of what others say about you and what they will threaten to do to you, because you are powerful and that you are worthy.
That's so beautiful. Thank you so much. And congratulations again.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Grace. And thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of No History, No Self.
I know we covered some heavy topics today, so please remember to take a few moments to rest and digest this information. I, for one, am about to go on a short walk around campus and maybe take a nap, eat. If you'd like to support our podcast, make sure to subscribe to our channel. Next week, we will be discussing the development of harmful stereotypes of Asian women perpetuated through racist, sexist, and limited media representation. We will talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.